just past 2 o'clock and you are listening to Southern FM. Welcome to the Space Show. In today's program, Storm on Saturn, Powerhouse Museum, news and other items. This is The Space Show, a program of space news and interviews presented at this time every second Sunday by the Space Association of Australia. First, the news.
In the United States, NASA has approved an extended mission for the radar-mapping Magellan spacecraft. The first cycle of its mapping program will be completed on May 15. Magellan is in orbit around the planet Venus, and has been using a radar device to map the rugged surface through the clouds which perpetually shroud the twin planet of the Earth. So far, 80% of the planet has been mapped. The extended mission will allow the remaining 20% to be mapped and for some parts to be remapped.
The Soviet Union's next mission to the Mir space station is due for launch on May the 12th. Soyuz TM-12 will carry Anatoly Arzebaski and Sergei Krikalev to orbit, where they will take over from Mir's current occupants for a 6-month shift. Arzebaski and Krikalev will be accompanied by a British technician, Helen Sharman, who is flying as part of the privately funded Juno project. Sharman will return to Earth in Soyuz TM-11 on May the 20th with Viktor Afanasyev and Muzhin Minarov, who have been in orbit since December 1990. Arzebaski is a test pilot and has been training for the Buran Space Shuttle and long-duration space station missions. This is his first flight. Krikalev has been in space before and has logged 151 days in orbit. Sharman is a former food technologist with the Mars Confectionery Company in Great Britain. She was one of 4 finalists selected from over 13,000 applicants for the mission.
A commercial launch of the Atlas Centaur rocket failed recently when range safety officers sent a radio signal to explode the vehicle about 360 seconds after launch. Aboard was a Japanese communications satellite that had been intended to beam television programs directly into people's homes. One of the rocket's 2 engines had not ignited, causing the vehicle to veer off course. The spacecraft and rocket were insured for $100 million.
All went well during the launch of an American communications satellite on April the 12th. A Delta II rocket placed SpaceNet 4 into an elliptical transfer orbit that was later circularized to 38,000 kilometers. It is expected to be placed into operation in late June. From its location above the equator west of Ecuador, SpaceNet 4 will relay news broadcasts, financial data, and commercial data.
Engineers at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory are trying to solve a problem that could cripple the science mission of the Galileo spacecraft. Galileo is on its way to study the planet Jupiter and its moons. When it arrives at Jupiter, it will need to use an umbrella-like antenna to transmit its findings back to Earth. After its launch in 1989 October, the antenna was kept folded. This was because Galileo had to pass close to the Sun on its way, and an unfolded antenna would have overheated. Now that Galileo has moved away from the Sun, it is safe to unfold the antenna. However, when the signal to unfold the antenna was sent, the umbrella only half unfolded and then jammed. The cause of the problem is not known.
It is now possible for passengers aboard aircraft to make telephone calls anywhere in the world. This follows the opening of 2 new Earth ground stations in Singapore and Norway. Until a few years ago, passengers aboard aircraft were unable to make telephone calls at all. Then ground receiving stations were opened in the United States, which relayed calls provided the aircraft was within sight of a station. 2 years ago, a company called Skyphone began a service to aircraft flying over the Atlantic Ocean by sending the calls from the aircraft up to an Inmarsat maritime communications satellite 38,000 kilometres above the equator. The satellite then sent the signal to a ground earth station, which passed the call into the terrestrial telephone system. Each Inmarsat satellite can view one-third of the world. One satellite each over the Atlantic, Pacific and Indian Oceans can cover the whole Earth. With the new stations in Norway and Singapore, aircraft can now access the Indian Ocean and Pacific Ocean satellites. British Airways was the first airline to introduce Skyphone. Calls can only be initiated from aircraft, so if you want to call your husband or wife and tell them that they've forgotten their toothbrush, too bad.
The fifth space shuttle orbiter has been delivered to the Kennedy Space Center, Florida. The Endeavour was built in Palmdale, California, as a replacement for the Challenger, which was destroyed soon after launch in 1986. The new vehicle has been named after Captain Cook's ship. This continues the tradition of naming space shuttle orbiters after ships of exploration. The Endeavour has some improvements over the older orbiters. These include new computers, a new life support system, more fuel to allow a longer stay in space, and a new toilet. The old toilet used to often clog up. The Endeavour was rolled out of the factory, loaded onto the back of a Boeing 747, then flown across country to Florida. On its first mission next year, the Endeavour will carry an Australian astronomy experiment, coincidentally called Endeavour.
Many of our listeners would perceive space activities as something remote from their lives. The space show seeks to remedy this. Another way to reduce that remoteness is to visit a museum at which space artifacts and models are displayed. One of Australia's most exciting museums is Sydney's Powerhouse in Ultimo. Andrew Rennie speaks to Kerry Doherty, Curator of Space Technology at the Powerhouse Museum.
Good afternoon, Kerry. Welcome to Southern FM.
Hello, Andrew. Nice to be here, and thank you for inviting me.
At the Powerhouse in Sydney, you have a number of space exhibits. What are they?
Well, the space exhibition is actually only one of about 25 major exhibitions at the Powerhouse, which cover the field from science and technology through decorative arts and even social history. The Powerhouse has a rather unique combination by including all these different subject areas. The space exhibition itself is also rather unique. Actually, I shouldn't say that. It's a bit of a tautology, isn't it? It is unique in being the only space exhibition in the world, as far as we're aware, which combines material from the three superpowers, that is, space-related material. We have items on display from the People's Republic of China, as well as the Soviet Union and the United States.
Yes, I've noted that actually in a number of museums overseas, they're concentrated on just that one country, usually the host country.
Yes, either that or you have, there's the one side of the story. It's either telling you the Russian side of the story if they happen to be an Eastern Bloc museum, or the American side of the story if they happen to be a Western museum. I have visited a few museums in Europe which do include both the Soviet and the American, but I've never met anyone else or seen any other museum that's also included the Chinese. And we thought that that was very important because, after all, China is an up-and-coming space power in our area. And we felt that it was important that Australians should be aware of China's involvement with space activity.
Yes, you have quite a number of Chinese artefacts there. What are they?
We have a 1/12 scale model of the Long March 3 rocket. Also, models of two of China's earliest satellites, Dongfang Heng 1, and pardon my Chinese, which was in fact China's first satellite, launched in 1970, and also Dongfang Heng 2, which was their first geostationary communications satellite, which was launched in 1984, if my memory serves me correctly. Also, we have some rather lovely Chinese space souvenirs. The Chinese particularly have produced, you know, some beautiful souvenir plates and things which relate to their space program, which are very, very lovely and delicate, and also some rather interesting examples of the very earliest rocketry. That is, of course, as most people would know, rocketry in the form of firework rockets, was developed in China anything up to 1,000 years ago. And some of the earliest uses for skyrockets, apart from just fireworks, were for rocket-powered weapons, what you might call very primitive terror devices. And the Chinese government actually made for us some beautiful reproductions of some of these very early rocket-powered devices, one of which is my favourite. It's called the Flying Dragon Out of Water. It's a large bamboo tube with a carved dragon's head and tail and a series of rockets which stick out from the base in such a way that they look like the dragon's legs. And the idea is that these rockets would be lit, and of course, just like a firework, like a skyrocket, the dragon would leap into the air. But then it had two harpoons in its mouth, which were also connected to fireworks. And when the legs burned out, the leg rockets burned out, they ignited the wicks for the harpoons in the mouth, and then these would fire out straight at the enemy. Now, I mean, the thing was probably grossly inaccurate, and half the time probably wouldn't do more than jump up into the air and fall back on the ground, but it would certainly frighten the living daylights out of an opposing warrior rushing towards it who'd never seen fireworks before.
It certainly would.
I think it would frighten the living daylights out of anyone now, actually.
Now, Australia plans to use one of the Long March rockets for launching OSSAT.
Yes, that's right. Coming up early next year, I believe, the launch has now been pushed back.
Yes. Which model of Long March will that be?
Long March 4, as I understand it. And we are, in fact, hoping that the Chinese government will, in fact, provide us with an updated Long March model for the exhibition.
Oh, splendid. I understand that the model that you have there is not quite the same one that's going to be launched by the Chinese. What's the model that you do have there of OSSAT?
Right, currently we have one of the first generation or A generation of OSSAT satellites, and that's a full-size model too, so it's about 18 feet. Sorry, I'm not metric when it comes to some of these things.
We'll forgive you.
Yes, but it's about 18 feet, and we have it hanging from the ceiling in the attitude that OSSAT actually orbits in its geostationary location around the Earth. But, in fact, we also hope to upgrade that next year with continuing sponsorship from the Hughes Aircraft Company, who very kindly sponsored our first replica, and so that then we'd have the upgraded OSSAT and the upgraded Long March both on display.
That would make it be quite unique in the world, wouldn't it?
Yes, we think so.
Now, the Soviets have a number of objects on display. Are any of them actual flight hardware? Are they all simulations?
No, a couple of them are. We have a full-size re-entry capsule for the Soyuz spacecraft, and although the capsule is a reproduction, the spacesuits inside, that is the crew inside, are wearing real spacesuits. And right next to that exhibit, we have a display case which contains an interesting variety of Soviet space food and the types of medical and hygiene equipment that the cosmonauts use, and also an original glove that was worn by cosmonaut General Vladimir Zhenebekov on his fourth space flight. And it has an interesting little story attached to it. If you ever visit the museum, you'll see there's a watch on the glove. And according to cosmonaut Zhenebekov, it never worked. And they used to wear American watches on their other wrist.
Well, we better not get into that sort of talk. Now, there's a strange wheeled vehicle there. It seems to have about eight wheels, I think, and a large lid. What is that?
Yeah, that's our Lunokhod. That is the moonwalking robot, which is the direct translation, actually. Lunokhod was a Soviet moon probe. There were two, one sent to the moon in 1970 and another in 1973. They were remotely controlled probes. That is, there was an operator on Earth who drove this thing like a remote controlled tank almost across the surface of the moon. And they're quite remarkable vehicles. The unfortunately, their biggest drawback apparently was the reaction time and the difficulty of actually controlling it from the Earth, because you have a 2.5 second delay either way with the signals going to and from the Earth to the Moon.
Did they have any mishaps from that?
Yes, they did. Lunokhod 2 actually came to grief because its operator back on Earth couldn't react fast enough when it ran up over a boulder.
Oh, I remember reading many years ago that they actually, the driver of the Lunokhod was actually a taxi driver roped off the streets of Moscow.
No. In fact, an interesting story that I heard from one of the Soviet delegates who came out to help us install that part of the exhibition was that, in fact, the pilots or drivers, whoever you like to call them, were qualified test pilots. And the task of manipulating the Lunokhod, there were actually five people who were involved in the driving of Lunokhod, but the task was so arduous that in fact they used to change the crews something like every 4 hours. That was about all that anybody could take because of the difficulty of maintaining both one's concentration and having to react in slow motion, as it were, to things that had already happened on the moon.
How was it powered?
Pardon me, solar cells and batteries for the lunar night when there were no immediate solar power available. The big lid that you're referring to, of course, if you look closely, you'll see it's all covered with blue solar cells. And that would flip up during the lunar day, or 14 Earth days of sunlight, and then close down during the lunar night to help keep the interior of the craft warm. In fact, I have to admit, we at the museum tend to refer to it as the ambulatory toilet seat because it tends to look a little bit that way with the lid flipped up.
Yes, I had noted the resemblance, actually. How did it find its way around the moon? I mean, how did the operator in Moscow know where to drive the thing? I mean, how did they avoid craters and things like that?
It had a pair of stereo movie cameras or TV cameras on the front of the craft. It also had radar sensors as well that enabled them to, you know, get a picture of the terrain. But I gather that what made it particularly difficult was that the television cameras were of the slow scan variety, so that it took time to build up a picture back on Earth. And the quality of it wasn't particularly high into the bargain, so it actually made it very difficult for the driver to see what was actually in front of him, particularly at times when the lunar shadows were, you know, at angles that were not particularly helpful for differentiating the terrain in front of you. And, of course, that's why the driver didn't see the boulder coming when he ran up over it and tipped the Lunokhod over.
Well, Kerry, thank you very much for coming with us tonight.
That's okay, my pleasure.
That was Andrew Rennie in conversation with Kerry Doherty, Curator of Space Technology, Powerhouse Museum, Sydney. Entry to the museum is free. And now here is Andrew with our regular segment on what you can see in the night sky this week.
If you look east at dawn, you may spot Mercury. It rises at 5 o'clock, just half an hour before the morning twilight. By 6 a.m. the planet is hidden by the brightening sky. This week offers the best opportunity all year to spot this elusive planet. Mercury is a small, rocky planet which orbits close to the Sun, so it's usually well hidden by the Sun's glare. Next Sunday, the Moon will pass within 9 degrees of Mercury. Now, when we say that the Moon is passing near a planet, we are, of course, talking of an optical illusion. The planets, of course, are hundreds of millions of kilometres away from each other, while the Moon is only 400,000 kilometres away from us. If you look north soon after sunset, you'll see fairly low in the sky the bright planet Jupiter, at the same time shining brilliantly in the northwest is the planet Venus. As the evening progresses, Venus sets quickly, while Jupiter slides around the northern sky to occupy the spot held earlier by Venus. By 11 p.m. Jupiter too has set. If you have a telescope, you may wish to turn it on the planet Saturn. A rare event has been occurring there, one which you can follow on your own backyard. Frank Tomlinson tells us more in the NASA Space Story.
NASA, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, presents The Space Story. Imagine storm clouds circling the entire planet at the equator. Would it be billed the storm of the century? Not a typhoon, hurricane, or blizzard, but a storm moving all the way around the planet. Well, that's what's happening on the planet Saturn. This latest event in space was discovered by an amateur astronomer, and soon NASA assigned the Hubble Space Telescope to take a look. As Caltech professor Andrew Ingersoll put it during a NASA news conference,
"To understand the possibilities, you have to remember that these planets, like Saturn, Jupiter, and so on, are fluid objects all the way to the center. There are no volcanoes erupting because there are no volcanoes. There's no solid crust. These planets are sort of bubbling cauldrons of liquid and gas, which makes the intermittency of these outbreaks so puzzling. You can sort of understand how a volcano, the pressure builds up under the solid crust and then bang, something gives way. With a bubbling fluid, what's there to build up?"
There was speculation that Saturn had been hit by a comet, but because Saturn is liquid throughout, Ingersoll quickly ruled that out.
"The kind of extraterrestrial impacts that happen once a century are just puny compared to this white spot on Saturn. So I think we can rule that possibility out. It really has to be some sort of internal intermittent thing on Saturn."
Reporters wanted to know if this sort of thing has ever happened before. The answer is yes, but never to this massive extent. The last time was 1933, when the clouds dissipated quickly. But now, some 58 years later, the cloud formation continues to grow. All of the scientists involved in studying the great white spot on Saturn agree that NASA's Hubble Space Telescope outdid itself. No worries, no problems, just great pictures. And as Professor Ingersoll noted, the pictures will be studied long and hard.
"We're probably in the next few weeks going to realize that it's also a circulating, complicated circulating storm system. Right now, you just see a pattern rather than see it move in detail. But we're going to get all the detailed motions. You know, everything in these atmospheres is hydrogen, helium, and what you see are clouds of ammonia and possibly mixtures of sulfur carbon compounds."
Trying to describe what happened, Ingersoll said the giant planet circling storm happened when Saturn burped. One reporter wanted to know if that Saturn burp could be compared to a pot of boiling cream of wheat or a pot of boiling water.
"Well, cream of wheat is different from boiling water. Boiling cream of wheat, it sort of develops a crust, and every now and then it does sort of burp. But boiling water just kind of churns along steadily and nothing builds up for very long. And naively, I think you'd expect Saturn to behave more like the pot of boiling water than the cream of wheat. It's hydrogen gas at the outer layers, and it's sort of hard to see why things should build up and then burp so magnificently. But yet, that's what it did."
That magnificent burp described by Professor Ingersoll may change a lot of theories about Saturn. Planetary scientist James Westfall says Saturn is now looking more like Jupiter, with what he calls this very convoluted, very colorful cloud structure. And what about that cloud structure? Is it just hanging there around Saturn's equator? Hardly. Listen to Andy Ingersoll.
"Relative to the interior of Saturn, it is moving at over 1,000 miles an hour. It's moving eastward at over 1,000 miles an hour. But now the detailed motions, swirling motions around this spot, that we have not yet measured."
This has been The Space Story, brought to you by this station and NASA. For the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, this is Frank Tomlinson.
The European Remote Sensing Satellite is designed to monitor the state of our planet. Aboard is an instrument made by British Aerospace Australia Limited of Adelaide. In February, the Australian Space Office committed $1 million for the establishment of a Tasmanian Earth Resources Satellite Station, which will allow Australia to receive data from this satellite as it surveys areas east and south of Australia. Here is Lawrence McGinty to explain what ERS-1 will do.
Europe's newest satellite will be the first ever to provide a round-the-clock doom watch from space, regardless of cloud cover. Bigger than the average bus, the satellite will carry special radar equipment to keep watch on the environment. Once launched, it will deploy a long aerial to receive radar signals bounced back from the Earth. Analyzing these signals produces images of a swathe of land under the satellite 100 kilometers across. This can pick up pollution, like this titanium dioxide spill in the Humber estuary, or can show vegetation and towns, as in this image of the Isle of Wight. But more than that, its sophisticated instruments can see through the clouds to monitor vital information, like wind, waves, and sea temperatures. That could be crucial in finding out whether the polar ice caps really are melting as a result of the greenhouse effect. ERS-1 will orbit 480 miles high over the poles. It covers the whole of the Earth every 3 days. Masses of information will be passed to Europe's tracking station. One instrument alone produces the equivalent of 5,000 pages of text every second. 24 hours a day, Europe's eye in the sky will keep watch over the Earth.
In our first program, we heard about the 30th anniversary of the flight of the first human in space, Yuri Gagarin. This month, we see another anniversary. Any ideas, Andrew?
Well, perhaps it could involve the first millionaire on the moon?
Could be.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. Lift off.
All right, lift off, and the clock has started. Yes, sir, reading you loud and clear. This is Freedom 7. The fuel is go, 1.2 G. Cabin at 14 PSI. Oxygen is go. Cabin pressure is holding at 5.5. Cabin holding at 5.5. Okay, it's a lot smoother now, a lot smoother.
Roger.
7 here, fuel is go, 4G, 5.5 cabin, oxygen go, all systems are go.
Well, what was it? 30th anniversary of something, or 25th anniversary of first millionaire in space? What was it, Andrew?
Well, I remember the event quite well, actually. I was a young child at the time, and I was glued to the Voice of America, and I actually heard this go off. It was, of course, Alan Shepard. It was on 1961, on May the 5th. I remember it well because it was my brother's birthday.
On the periscope, what a beautiful view. Cloud cover over Florida. 3 to 4 tenths near the eastern coast. Obscures up through Hatteras. I can see Okeechobee. Identify Andros Island. Identify the reefs. Start retro sequence. In retro attitude, arc green. Control is smooth. Retro one. Very smooth. Retro 2. Retro 3. All 3 retros are fired.
Okay, so it was the first flight of an American in space, whereas the one we had a couple of weeks ago was the first flight of a Russian in space. Of course, the difference was, though, that Shepard's flight was just a suborbital flight, just up and down. It wasn't into orbit. But what about the millionaire bit?
Well, as a result of this flight, Shepard, of course, was very famous. He made a number of business contacts and went into business. He made millions of dollars while still remaining an astronaut. So by the time of Apollo 14 in 1971, when he made it to the moon, he was a millionaire, and so became the first and only millionaire to reach the moon.
The Space Association of Australia is a non-profit, non-political group of space enthusiasts who are keen to learn about and share with others the excitement of space exploration. This is our third program, and we are eager to hear your thoughts on the content and presentation of the Space Show. Any comments, feedback, or general inquiries about the Space Association can be sent to us care of this station or to our address at P.O. Box 351, Mulgrave North, 3170. That's P.O. Box 351, Mulgrave North, 3170.
Our apologies to our regular listeners that last week we weren't on air because of the radiothon. However, we'll be back again next week at 2 p.m. Please listen.
I'm Mark Hillier.
And Andrew Rennie.
You've been listening to The Space Show.